Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
A warm welcome to Guardian Daily. It's Monday, December the 15th. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, we are about to enthusiastically reveal the extent of working class apathy.
The figures on white boys in terms of education are now quite clear and quite frightening.
We speak to our man inside the Taliban.
Suddenly there's like a strong sense of stepping into another world engulfs you.
Ding dong merrily on high, the gay carol singers of Northern Ireland. And what baby birds singing in their sleep can tell us.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
First, Sandy Waugh with a news update and a review of the papers.
The head of Barclays Bank is predicting economic gloom gripping the UK will deepen further. Group Chief Executive John Varley is painting a bleak outlook, saying house prices are set to tumble by up to 30%. The bank boss also suggested unemployment figures will soar, saying it's likely to go north of 7% over the course of the next 12 months. The comments made on Sky News will be seen as highly significant in the city as they come from such an eminent figure. George W. Bush has arrived in Afghanistan on a surprise visit to the country. The outgoing president spoke to US soldiers and Marines at a hangar on the tarmac at Bagram Air Base. It's Bush's first trip to the country in more than 2.5 years and only the second of his presidency. Security's tight after extraordinary scenes on a short visit to Iraq just hours before. During a press conference in Baghdad, an Iraqi reporter managed to hurl both his shoes at the US president. You can see the footage at guardian.co.uk/video. An NHS doctor held captive by her family in Bangladesh will arrive back in Britain today. 33-year-old Dr. Humaira Abedin was put under pressure to marry against her will. The alarm was raised when she sent an email to a friend requesting help. Her return follows an order made by the British High Court, issued under the new Forced Marriages Act. And triple Olympic gold medal winner Chris Hoy has been named the BBC Sports Personality of the Year. The 32-year-old Scottish cyclist hadn't been the bookies' favourite, but romped home well ahead of Formula One champion Lewis Hamilton and Olympic swimmer Rebecca Adlington. Paralympic swimmer Eleanor Simmons was named the Young Sports Personality. Despite US swimmer Michael Phelps picking up 8 Olympic golds in Beijing, Jamaican sprinter Usain Bolt was named Overseas Sports Personality. Team of the Year was the British Olympic cycling team, who won 14 medals in the summer, 8 of them golds. A quick look at this morning's papers now. The Telegraph picks up on Gordon Brown's comments about Pakistan's links to terrorism, with the PM saying more than 20 serious plots involving attacks on civilian targets in Britain are being planned there. A Times investigation has uncovered that a man wanted by Interpol for his links to an alleged terrorist organisation has been advising Scotland Yard on countering Muslim extremism. The pound to be left to its fate is the headline in The Independent. Ministers have declared the plummeting currency will not be propped up by government intervention. The Guardian has an exclusive dispatch from Afghanistan with a report from behind enemy lines and an interview with a Taliban fighter who says, "When I started, I had 6 fighters. Now I have 500. The Express warns a killer virus is gripping Britain, saying millions face being struck down by a deadly winter vomiting bug. The Mirror reports on the Strictly Come Dancing phone-in fiasco, saying there'll be no refund for angry viewers who want their money back. On its back page, it reports how the Chelsea boss, Luis Felipe Scolari, has spent a night in hospital with kidney stones. And The Sun has a piece on how Michael Owen will open talks over a new Newcastle deal tomorrow. More on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
First, we tackle the ongoing and challenging problem of how to motivate Britain's young people. A report published today shows there's a working class apathy, which is blighting whole communities, particularly white working class boys in northern cities. Cabinet Office Minister Liam Byrne is arguing for major public service reforms as he believes the government has failed to establish a systematic, cultural and behavioural approach to lifting aspiration. The Guardian's political editor Patrick Winter has the details.
The Cabinet Office, or a branch of the Cabinet Office, the Social Exclusion Task Force, is due to publish on Tuesday a fresh report on why young people in deprived communities are not doing well at education. And if you look internationally, the figures aren't great, and they also have implications for social mobility. And what they're doing is trying to take it on a new angle at it, which is this issue of aspiration of young people. whether there's a desire to do well. And what they've been trying to disentangle some figures from is why there is, in some deprived communities, relatively high levels of aspiration, given the degree of income deprivation, and why in other parts of Britain there's such low levels of aspiration. And they sort of feel that unless they tackle this issue of aspiration, the desire to do well, a sense of having a stronger horizons, they're not really going to make as much progress as they would want on education, because certainly if you look at the education achievement figures, there's been some progress, but there's an element of levelling off in the last few years. And what they seem to have come up against is that it's not necessarily just deprivation which leads to low aspiration, it's also slightly more cultural, sociological factors such as the degree of cohesion and sense of community within the area that they've been examining. So they've seemed to find out that in large cities in the north, where there's large social housing, people on income support, there are low horizons, but then if you look at some Asian areas of high deprivation in Britain, there is a very strong sense of aspiration and relatively high GCSE scores. So what they're trying to look at is how you can build a sense of community and a sense of aspiration within those communities.
Let's clarify who we're talking about, because some of this does fly in the face of maybe expected opinion, because it's white working class boys that we're talking about, not ethnic minorities, isn't it?
Yes, one of the strongest pieces of the research is in fact that there is it's white working class boys that seem to be the most immune to having any sense of aspiration, and whether they get that from their parents or from the communities in which they live, it's sort of not clear. But what they're trying to do is think of ways in which they can get these young working class boys to think more ambitiously about what they could do with their lives.
And this is one of those grand statements, isn't it? We must raise the aspirations of our young people. Easily said, not too easily done.
No. I mean, what I suppose what they're trying to draw out is this sense that communities matter, that it's certain types of neighbourhood you're less likely to be ambitious and achieve your aspirations. And it's not just that all deprived communities are the same. There's different results in different communities. And what you need to do is develop these kinds of, what in the jargon is called social capital, this idea that you can bond together and achieve things together. And in one telling phrase, the Cabinet Office Minister in the interview we've conducted with him talks, Liam Byrne talks in terms of, in the medieval period, communities were built around the manor. In the 19th century, communities were built around the factory. And in the 21st century, we need to build communities around schools, expanded schools, which deal not just in education, but in further education, retraining, and in health. Try and develop some sense of public space in which teachers and not just parents can start to influence the way in which these young kids think. But the figures on white boys in terms of education are now quite clear and quite frightening. And it's not just a white, black, or white ethnic minority issue. It's a white boy versus the rest of society issue.
And finally, just a brief answer, is there an anti-apathy budget for this?
I would say the problem with the government is that they have millions of small little schemes of which have equally sort of £5 million budgets to do this and that. And what the Cabinet Office is trying to do is draw together the work that's been done so far. But potentially there's a lot of money there, because if you think there's what certainly Liam Byrne talks about is there's a sort of multi-billion pound school rebuilding program going on at present. And there's also a lot of money going into the health service. So there is lots of money there. It's a question of also trying to draw together the different public services and try and make them work closer together. And he argues one of the things they're going to have to learn from this is to allow the public services to innovate at local level in a way they weren't, certainly in the first 10 years of the Blair-Brown government, where the axis was very much on central targets. And he's openly admitting that era is now over.
Patrick Winter. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, the credit crunch is leading to a rise in the number of missing persons. Details at guardian.co.uk/news. Robot labour is on its way. Find out if you could be replaced by an automaton at guardian.co.uk/business. How the Vikings got their groove. Discover what I'm talking about at guardian.co.uk/culture. And the sports personality of the year goes to... Find out if you don't already know at guardian.co.uk/sport. Next, to Pakistan, where Gordon Brown has been confronting his counterpart, Ali Asif Zardari, for not doing enough to stem the flow of terrorists to and from Pakistan and the UK. In a whistle-stop tour, the Prime Minister announced that 75% of the most serious terror plots investigated in the UK are linked to Pakistan, and he's unveiled a £6 million fund to help sever those ties. Our senior foreign correspondent, Jason Burke, has been following the story.
What he's saying is more about the realisation in the UK that Southwest Asia, particularly Afghanistan and, as a result, Pakistan, is where our foreign policy, British foreign policy, is going to have very significant interests over the coming years. I think there's been a slow realisation, but now a quite deep realisation, that Afghanistan can't be solved without Pakistan being solved, if you like, and that that depends on the Indo-Pakistani relationship. So I think there's a sudden realisation that after several years where we've been rather distracted, that South Asia is the place where we're going to have to concentrate a lot of effort.
Will Pakistan be appeased in any way by Gordon Brown's unveiling of a £6 million deal to stop terrorism between the UK and Pakistan?
£6 million is, in global terms, not a very significant amount of money. The Pakistanis will accept it. It rather depends on how it's used. By comparison, the Americans have spent the last couple of years putting together a £500 or £600 million program, which is to be used for bettering social economic conditions for development in the crucial tribal regions along the western border of Pakistan, which just shows that £6 million is not a huge amount of money. The Pakistanis also have a slightly ambivalent attitude to these kinds of things. They don't like taking money. They see it often as a humiliation. They would like to be much more independent than they are. That said, the fact that the Americans have given over the last decade somewhere between $10 and $15 billion to support the Pakistani military effort against the militants has been extremely welcome. And of course, the international aid that is currently propping up the Pakistani economy is equally welcome. I mean, as I say, given the scale of those kind of commitments, £6 million here or there don't really make a great deal of difference. But it will be welcome, and I think there are certainly plenty of people within the Pakistani security establishment who are keen to work more closely with the British on certain issues, and very keen to keep British intelligence a fair distance away from certain other issues.
Finally, Jason, do you think that Gordon Brown is redefining George Bush's axis of evil with his assertion that jihadis or militants, extremists from training camps in Pakistan, flow into Afghanistan and then on through Europe into the UK?
Brown, apart from not having anywhere near the international weight to redefine anything like the axis of evil, is in this instance stating what has been a fairly coherent British position for some time, which is to emphasise the role Pakistan plays. This has been a policy for two or three years now, which sees the British government, all organs of the British government actually, the Foreign Ministry, Secret Services and so forth, all emphasising repeatedly the role that Pakistan and Pakistani groups play within the global networks of international Islamic militancy. And that is of particular interest to Britain, of course, because we have a big British-Pakistani community with major, often cultural, social, familial links back to Pakistan. So we see ourselves in a very difficult position in terms of the phenomenon known as Al-Qaeda, in that we have particular vulnerabilities due to our links with Pakistan, where many of the key militant individuals are. So I think it's actually far more domestic in terms of our interest, and much less about some kind of new global vision of Islamic militancy and its roots.
Jason Burke.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
We stay in Southwest Asia now to hear exclusively from our reporter who's been talking to members of the Taliban in the provinces of Afghanistan. Gaith Abdul Ahad is an Iraqi journalist who writes for The Guardian. He's been telling us about his latest assignment.
I was very worried that I will take my Iraq experience and overimpose it on Afghanistan. But then I realized that Afghanistan is much different than Iraq, that each little town, each little valley has its own problems, fighting their own war. I realized that the Taliban, in one way or another, they are so different from the Iraqi insurgents. They have a plan, they have a strategy, they have, in one way or another, a one structure, a one command. They have the same ideology, unlike the Iraqis, which is kind of different different groups. Traveling around Afghanistan was also another learning process, because, as I said, I learned how different the country is. From each village to another village, you have a different dynamic.
From your experience, do you get a sense of how the Afghans feel about the Taliban currently?
Well, here is the thing. It's not that most of the Afghans I met were supporting the Taliban, but almost every single Afghan I met was so disappointed with both the Karzai government and with the NATO and American forces. And again, every single Afghan I met in 2001 was so happy to get rid of the Taliban and get a new prospect, a new future and everything. But then what's been happening of poverty, corruption, I mean, poverty in Afghanistan is stunning. It's the 19th century in one way or another. But the poverty, the corruption, the unemployment, and of course the repeated killing of civilians in Afghanistan, all these things made a lot of people, even secular, say, well, the days of the Taliban were much better because at least we had security. And that's the thing that you keep hearing again and again in Afghanistan.
Have you actually found evidence of any link between Taliban and Al-Qaeda?
Links between Taliban and Al-Qaeda... No, the Taliban I met were, if we can use the word, a local Taliban. They were people from the same villages. They were fighting in the same villages. And most of the leaders were kind of in their like late 30s, commanders, I would say. They were in their late 30s. So they were kind of part of the old Taliban. Most of the fighters were like a new generation started fighting in the last 3-4 years. Now, having said that, I met a couple of Taliban who spoke perfect Arabic. The Arab presence in Afghanistan is very clear, but did I find any signs of Al-Qaeda working with the Taliban? No, maybe because I didn't kind of travel to all the areas controlled by the Taliban.
And finally, when in the presence of the Taliban, what sort of things do you have to be careful about?
I have to say something. When I entered that room, the room where I was to meet the Taliban for the first time, you know, you take off your shoes, you kind of step into that room, and suddenly there is like a strong sense of stepping into another world engulfs you. We can write about these things, we can take pictures of these things, but when you enter a room with a dozen men wearing huge silk turbans, having black around their eyes, big, huge beards and guns all over the room, whoever you are and whatever the things you've done in your life and the people you've met, entering that room is an experience by its own.
Gaith Abdul-Ahad. Still to come, why scientists have been strapping electrodes to the heads of baby birds. Before that, in a year when the wife of Northern Ireland's First Minister, Iris Robinson, branded homosexuality as an abomination which can be cured by psychotherapy, the gay and lesbian community of Belfast has come together to make history by holding its first ever gay carol service inside a church. Around 200 people attended the event last week, and according to veteran gay rights campaigner Jeff Dudgeon, it proves that Belfast is more liberal and tolerant than some of what he describes as the city's more raucous voices. The Guardian's Ireland editor Henry MacDonald has been speaking to the man behind the idea.
The Reverend Hudson, I mean, this is your church. It's a big first for not only Northern Ireland, but Ireland. You have the gay community here tonight celebrating Christmas. Why did you decide to do it?
Well, it's very simple. I believe that people come to my church as complete people, not as part people. If somebody is gay, I don't ask them to leave their sexuality outside the church, no more than if somebody came to my church and they were a black person, would I ask them to leave their pigmentation outside the church. We invite people in their completeness to come in here. And also, I personally believe that to a large extent, still in the United Kingdom, there is an element of homophobia. And that because of this, gay and lesbian people don't enjoy complete and full rights like the rest of us. I think we're at a point of changing that. But here in Northern Ireland, because of the remarks of certain politicians, it has made it more difficult, and many gay and lesbian people are nervous because of those remarks. And I think it's the duty of the church to reassure them that they are welcome in the spirit and love of God into our churches, to embrace them in their completeness, and to support them in their struggle for complete rights that give them dignity like every other human being.
I think it's very significant that this service is taking place in a church, and that there's such a good turnout, and it shows that not all Christians are opposed to gay and lesbian people living their lives positively and proudly.
I think it leaves 2008 on a really positive note. It hasn't been the most positive for the gay community, if you like, but most of all for gay individuals, really, because the gay community can sort of withstand it, but it's the individuals who maybe feel a bit more isolated. And I think tonight was a lovely opportunity for those individuals to feel included and feel that the church, which is such a huge institution in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, that, you know, they're not totally unwelcome everywhere. So it's a really lovely message, I think.
You know, it's very heartwarming to see a couple of hundred people in the city of Belfast coming out to a service for lesbians and gays and bisexuals and transgendered people, and I just find it rather moving. And it's well, there's other religious people in the city who might not find it so, but I think they're distressingly wrong.
Did you ever think, you know, all those years ago when you were taking Northern Ireland to the Court of Human Rights in Europe and, you know, over discrimination, that you would see a day when you would see a service like this in a Presbyterian church in Belfast?
Well, probably not, actually, but at the same time, I'm surprised by very little in many ways. Because people are so essentially good-natured, and well, the people here have welcomed us, and it's great.
Is it not a sign of the times?
It is, yeah. I think it's a sign that the world has emancipated gay people, certainly in Belfast, which has always been a more liberal place than many other people would suggest. Just has rather raucous voices as well.
Finally, I leave you with this newly learned fact. Baby birds learn to sing in tune by replaying songs in their heads while asleep. To find out why we needed to know this and how it might answer some other important questions, we've been speaking to The Guardian's science correspondent Ian Sample.
Well, this was really a bit of research to look at how the very first stages of changes in the brain when someone learns something, or when, in this case, when an animal learns something. And people have known for a long time that sort of sleep is involved in memory formation. But actually how the memory does that, it hasn't been really well known. So in this experiment, what they did is they tried to look at exactly what happens in the brains of these birds as they learn to sing songs from birth. I mean, these were chicks that were raised in isolation. They'd never sang before. They babble. They make this little noise like babies would, if you like, just a little babble. But they've been raised in isolation, so they'd never heard an adult sing before, so they didn't know how to copy the song. And in this experiment, what they did is they had these chicks that had been raised in isolation, say they put them in an enclosure where they could pull on a little bit of string with their beak, and it played the adult song to them. Now, what happened is the birds go quite crazy for this, and they would start pulling this string all the time and hearing this adult sing to them. The birds then try and copy it. Now, where the sort of neuroscience of this comes in is that if you look at the brain activity of the birds during the day, you get some. But when they go to sleep, you can look at the activity again, and what happens is you can tell that they're playing over the tunes in their head. And when you look at their performance the next day, they sing a lot better. So this means that they're actually, the learning and the actual improvement is all achieved in the brain overnight.
On a practical level, a practical question for you, how do you know what goes on in a bird's head?
They managed to find a way of, when the birds were asleep, they basically secured their heads with a little strap, and they had tiny electrodes going into this tiny part of the brain, which is purely to do with learning. And you can monitor the activity of individual neurons by doing that. So it's like an extraordinary precise way of seeing what's going on in an animal's brain while it sleeps. And you could do this during the day as well, but what was interesting here was what happened at night. And the activity they saw really mirrors what goes on in their brains when they're singing and when they're hearing these tunes. So it's just a sort of a going over a song in your head to help you learn it. Is this a common thing among different types of animals and even humans? And the scientists seem to think that absolutely that it is. It's very possible, very plausible even, that other animals and us will learn things the same way. I mean, what it will do is it certainly tells you the benefits if you're trying to learn something. It tells you the benefits of getting a good night's sleep. There's also another aspect of this research which showed that when they tried singing back to themselves, it was as if they had their memory of what the song should sound like, and then they would sing it back to themselves when they were awake and when they were asleep, actually. And it was that fine-tuning that really helped them grasp it. And I think it just is interesting to lay bare exactly how the brain does this, because the more you know about something like this, the better you can sort of focus on doing it.
Ian Sample. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. Tuesdays will be online from 7:30 in the morning. Producing today were Ian Chambers and Andy Duckworth. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.